Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week we take a look back at some of our favorite moments from the top episodes we released in 2022. From poet laureates and Pulitzer Prize winners to screenwriters, novelists, and more, we hope you enjoy entering the minds of these writers. We begin with acclaimed author Hanif Abdurraqib, who chatted with us in February along with illustrator Ashley Evans about their children's picture book, Sing Aretha Sing. In this clip, Abdurraqib shares why he chose to focus on Aretha's legacy in the civil rights movement and the role gospel music served as the soundtrack of that movement.
There's a way that I had begun to believe that there's, no matter how much there is to that that has been said about Aretha Franklin, it can never be enough. And so I wanted to pursue that impulse.
She's meant so much to so many people, and steadily. So how did you narrow it down into this one particular song and this particular moment?
Yeah, like it's tough because I knew that, I'm someone who has gotten really good, for better or worse. I think it's a bit heartbreaking, but necessary tool at kind of writing in almost immediate obituary type of piece about someone. And I think it's because you can't encapsulate a life, but I think that we can stretch out a moment and everyone can kind of pick their moment to marvel at. And I'm fascinated by the transformation of the song Respect between as it passed from Otis Redding's hand to Aretha's hands, and how more than that, I was really spending a lot of time immersed in these conversations and thoughts about where protest music is going, or these kind of conversations about soundtracks to a movement. And I felt like they were lacking some historical context, particularly around the civil rights movement, and not just around Respect, but how the gospel songs were the songs of these movements. And, you know, Black women were often at the forefront of the singing in these movements and presenting songs for these movements. And so it felt like a good portion, a small portion of Aretha's life that I could kind of take and illuminate.
Next up, screenwriter Aaron Sorkin discussed the process of adapting Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird for the stage. This program was part of the inaugural American Writers Festival in May. In this clip, Sorkin explains how and why he centered Atticus Finch as the main protagonist in his stage adaptation of the novel.
I went back, I threw that first draft out, and I started again. This time, facing some hard truths about To Kill a Mockingbird, the novel. Perhaps one of the more important ones was this. Atticus in the novel, and in the movie as well, doesn't change. He's the same person at the end of the story as he is at the beginning. And a protagonist has to change, and a protagonist has to have a flaw. And I thought, why then was Harper Lee able to get away with having an Atticus who didn't change? Why was Horton Foote, who won an Oscar for writing the screenplay, why was he able to get away with having an Atticus who's the same at the end as he is at the beginning? And the answer is, in the book and in the movie, Atticus isn't the protagonist, Scout is. She changes by losing some of her innocence. Her flaw is that she's young. Well, I wanted to keep the kids, Scout, her brother Jem, their friend Dill, I wanted to keep them as protagonists, but I wanted the central protagonist to be Atticus, which meant he was going to have a flaw and he was going to have to change. So what was that going to be? Was he going to go from being a good father to a bad father to a good father, a bad lawyer to a good lawyer, a racist to someone who believes in equality, justice, and inclusion? And No. And then I realized, just reading the book again, there were a number of things in the book that I found troubling about Atticus. And primarily, it was that he is constantly excusing racism. Bob Yule, who is in the book and in the movie, he's just a horrible racist. In the play, I made him what he is, which is a Klan member. About Bob Yule, he says, well, you got to understand, he just lost his WPA job. That makes a man feel small. So, you know, let's walk in Bob Yule's shoes for a mile and see how we feel. the next door neighbor, Mrs. DeBose, is a terrible racist. Well, you got to understand, she just stopped taking her medication, and that changes a person about the whole town. You got to understand, this is the Deep South. Things move slower here in the Deep South. Just give Makem time. And his belief that there's goodness that can be found in everyone, and to really know someone, you've got to crawl around in their skin. That moment, sort of in my thinking of that Atticus, already had a flaw. It's just that it was taught to us as a virtue, this idea that there's goodness in everyone and you have to crawl around in everyone's skin. It was right around that time that Donald Trump got up and said there were very fine people on both sides. And I thought, okay, here it is. Not for a moment do I think that Atticus and Donald Trump are the same person. There's plenty of daylight between the two of them. Just not enough daylight for my taste, for a hero. So Atticus was going to go from, just as the country in the last 4, 5, 6 years has kind of gone through an awakening of, I thought that a lot of this stuff was 60 years ago, was deep in our past and isolated to Mississippi. This awakening of who our friends and neighbors were. They weren't quite who I thought they were. This was going to be the journey that Atticus was going to take. This awakening.
Another program from the American Writers Festival. Up next is Maxine Hong Kingston and Viet Thanh Nguyen, who discussed Kingston's body of work and legacy. A new collection of Kingston's work is available from the Library of America, which Nguyen edited. In this clip, Kingston discusses the power of storytelling and owning myths, and describes how she combined details of two myths into one of her own to give herself and another woman power.
I do not give the correct classical versions. I think one of the worst things that I did was I wrote about Fa Mugglan kneeling as her parents carve words on her back, dedicating her to China. And okay, that did not happen to Fa Mugglan. That happened to Yu Fei. He, a man, a warrior, and I just took these two myths and I put them together. And so that's right, I got it wrong. The Chinese critics have also criticized my books for getting the myths wrong. What the Chinese did when they did the translations, they tried to help me out because if I got something wrong, they just deleted it from their edition. But you know, I did that on purpose because when I was writing those books, I believed in myth and in storytelling. And if I could own a myth, then I could have that power. So I wanted to give women the same powers that Yu Fei had. So I just incorporated his story into my story.
Up next, we have another stage adaptation with singer-songwriter Ingrid Michaelson and playwright Becca Brunstetter, who adapted the novel The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks for the stage. The two visited the American Writers Museum in August to discuss their process ahead of the world premiere of the musical at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. In this clip, they share how their own personal experiences with love and loss impacted their work on The Notebook.
So are there ways that the story of The Notebook like relates to your own lives and how, you know, has that affected the creative process of adapting this?
Yes. The idea of loss and persevering through loss, at the time when Kevin, The Notebook to me, my mother had passed in 2014, my father was still with us, and then my father passed in 2017 while I was actively writing the music. So this concept of trying to keep the light going when it's very hard to, is kind of my religion. It's an active choice that I still practice this religion daily. Sometimes I don't do as well as other days, but this idea of just, I mean, who said it? Shakespeare, love is the thing. Love is the thing. Love, not always romantic love, but love and connection and human to human contact, which is something that we just are so desperate for now. Even just like we're in rehearsals with masks. We'll start the day in a circle and we'll just all take a breath, put our masks down while holding our breath and stare at each other's faces for like 3 seconds, just so we can see. So I think there's something about love, loss, connection, humanity that is just all rumbling around in my head at all times of the day. And so I get to sort of like put it through like the meat grinder of my brain and it comes out in song form, song sausages for you all.
Yeah. Yes, I love it.
Yeah. Ew.
They're delicious. And I have a lot of Alzheimer's in my family. Mm-hmm. My grandfather, who actually just passed away last month, suffered from it for many, many years. And my uncle got it when he was only 55. He's about 5 years in now. So that was really, having seen what that did to my family and my grandparents, and it just, I love attaching myself to anything that I've lived in any way, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was just kind of like showing this, you know, story, this love story at the end of these couples' lives was really, felt really important to me. Just like the lasting, just like a hopeful love story. I love working on anything that is hopeful and that, you know, encourages people to find love.
Up next, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Marinus stopped by the American Writers Museum to discuss his new biography, The Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe, with scholar Kelly Weiskop. In this clip, the two discuss the lack of representation of Indigenous peoples in the media and the importance of being able to tell your own stories your own way, not through the lens of white America.
The movie is sympathetic but wrong in every small respect and wrong in the largest respect. You know, it has mountains in Oklahoma, you know, it's all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But the real problem with it, in my opinion, was that the narrator is Pop Warner. And he's presented as the white savior. If only Jim had listened to him and better assimilated into society, he would have had the troubles he had. And I found that to be just classically a white wrong perspective on the whole thing.
Yeah. And yet another moment where it's not Jim getting to tell his own story.
No, it's right? not. And it's not, you know, there was obviously absolutely no even thought in that era that maybe we could tell this through the Native perspective.
Yeah. It
just wasn't done.
It's really interesting thinking about Thorpe's advocacy for Native people, you know, playing Native characters in films alongside the recent kind of wave of TV shows.
Oh,
I'm thinking about Rutherford Falls and Reservation Dogs,
yeah.
Written, directed, acted in by Native people.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of think about Thorpe as somebody who's hoping and imagining a 2022 when there are going to be two great and TV shows directed by Native actors,
yeah.
Directors and featuring Native actors.
Well, I've always said that all of my books are in various stages of not being made into movies. And I don't care if it's based on my book or not, but I think that a story of Jim Thorpe told through a Native American director and actors would be fabulous.
I hope they're listening to this podcast because I agree. as we kind of wind down, you know, I want to ask what you hope readers take away from encountering Thorpe's story, the letters he wrote, the speeches he gave, his activism, his athleticism. What do you hope readers take from the book?
Well, you know, I think readers often read into a book what they take from their own lives. Mm-hmm. So, my effort is to try to let that in and then teach them something as well, you know. So if people come into it just thinking of Jim Thorpe as this great athlete, I want them to understand it in the context of what he dealt with as a Native American. And as I said earlier, I think that it's really a lesson in survival and persistence, and which I think emblemizes the entire Native population.
Up next, recorded live at the American Writers Festival in May, U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo and Literary Director of the Library of Congress, Marie Arana, explored the themes of their roots, their creativity, and how their origin stories feed them and their work. In this clip, Harjo shares how she first discovered the power of poetry and the importance of meeting real, living Native poets in her evolution as a poet.
It was knowing that it was becoming part of Native rights movements as a member of Kiva Club, the Native Student Club, and it was also meeting real Native poets and realizing, oh my, wow, you know, I loved Emily Dickinson, I loved all this poetry, but my image of a poet was an old white man in England, because that's what we were reading mostly at school at that time, which was fine, I loved the poems. Because poetry can speak across culture boundaries. I mean, there's language can get in the way, but it you know, it has that power. But to meet Native poets, you know, I knew Leslie Marmon Silko, the novelist, first as a poet, her poetry, and then her short stories, and then her novels. Simon Ortiz, James Welch, and that's when I started writing. And it took over, and I still don't understand. I mean, we didn't grow up with poets in our neighborhood. We did not grow up hearing ourselves as part of poetry. Rather, it was something the teachers were afraid to teach. And then I came to learn how poetry is always there at transformational moments, and we were certainly in a transformational moment at that time in history, just like we are now. And poetry becomes a poem becomes a kind of transformer station to make a shift, to change, to make a place, where you can communicate without words, but absolutely with words.
Up next, also recorded live at the American Writers Festival, Danielle Clayton and Jacqueline Woodson discussed Clayton's middle grade debut novel, The Marvelers, a fantasy adventure set in a global magic school in the sky. In this clip, Clayton shares insights into her character development and also the importance of young readers seeing characters who look like them in the books they read.
So for those of you who don't know, the world of children's books is small. So we all talk and drink and talk and gossip and get together. But you don't have to name the name, but will you tell that story about the writer who didn't believe in magic?
Yes. Okay, so if you get the book, you'll see who I dedicated the book to. It's Jason Reynolds. If you don't know him, please read his work. It's phenomenal. But we've been in a series of arguments for like probably a decade about magic. He hates it, and he hates dragons. And so I dedicated the book to him. I said, you know, this book is for Jason Reynolds, who hates dragons. Beloved readers, please ask him why. So for the rest of his life, small children ask him why he hates dragons, because I am a troll, and that's what friends do. That's what friends are for. But he told me, he said that he felt like as a child, his imagination was taken from him very early by the nature of being a black American boy. And he said he didn't have room for magic. And that made me incredibly sad, because I had so much room for magic. And I wanted to make sure that other kids that looked like him would be able to see themselves in magical settings and be able to imagine themselves as having powerful magic. And it's one of the reasons why there is a cute boy on my cover who loves magical animals and can talk to them. And I just wanted to be able to showcase that and help grow imaginations. That's what I think middle grade fiction does really well. But I do think something in our community where our kids don't get to have magic. They get to have the real. They have to be prepared and armed for what they're going to face and the hostility. And I wanted to find a way to build a bridge with
magic.
That's
so interesting, because you also have a girl who dislikes magic.
I do. She's more like me. So my main character, Ella, she loves magic. She loves where she comes from. She's also an ambassador from her community going into this other community. And she's just like, let me show you what conjurers can do. Let me show you like why you shouldn't be afraid, all of that, that we are awesome, which I felt like as a black child I had to do, being one of two or three. I had to be this sort of perfect ambassador. But her roommate and her best friend at school is a grumpy white girl who hates everything. That was more like me. I hate in middle school, I hated it. I just want to read my book. I don't want to be like, don't look at me. I'm reading my book. Leave me alone. Let me be up to my own devices. and she hates it, but she belongs more than my main character because she's a legacy student. So I wanted to showcase that there are different ways that you can come at this idea of magic and whether you like it or not.
Up next, Reina Grande stopped by the American Writers Museum in October to chat with Juan Martinez about her recent books as well as her general writing process. In this clip, she answers a question from a program attendee about who she writes for and empowering the Mexican-American community by reclaiming and correcting American history.
Well, I have different audiences in mind. You know, I have, for example, with the Mexican-American community, I really wanted the book to empower this community because for so long, we have been made to feel that we don't belong here, that we're the outsiders. And yet in learning our history, we realize, wait a minute, we were here first. What are you talking about? You know, I mean, like the state that I call home, California, like I've grown up there most of my life, and I've been told by dominant society that I'm the foreigner, right? That I'm the outsider, and that speaking Spanish is bad, and that I shouldn't do that. And then in learning this history and understanding the history, I became empowered, and I realized I'm not the foreigner here. I'm not the outsider here. You know, I do have a right to call California my home. And so to me, that's really important for us to empower ourselves and reclaim this history, because we do need to acknowledge that the Mexican-American community is part of this country and has always been, even before this territory, you know, that the United States took from Mexico belonged to the United States. So that to me is important. But in general, like, I just want readers to start to understand how we cannot continue to erase moments in U.S. history that don't fit into the national mythology. You know, we need to demand for a corrective history. And in doing that, we're also trying to make sure that we don't continue to lie to ourselves about what country we are and what kind of country we have been. And like I said earlier, you know, the more we learn about our history, even if it makes us uncomfortable, the more we can together decide what kind of country we really want to be.
Poet and essayist Ross Gay is up next, who visited the American Writers Museum in November to celebrate the release of his latest essay collection, Inciting Joy. In this clip, he reads an excerpt from an essay about time and how poetry can, in effect, stop the march of time, if even for a moment.
Unless you are among the prophets and profiteers of progress, which so often is another word for murder, albeit sometimes murder outsourced, you too might have been praying for a way to stop the march of so-called time. And poems sometimes might do that. Poems are made of lines, which are actually breaths. And so the poem's rhythms, its time, is at the scale and pace and tempo of the body, the tempo of our bodies lit with our dying. And poems are communicated ultimately body to body, voice to ear, heart to heart. Footnote, the heart's perhaps the most reliable clock we have. Even if those hearts are not next to one another in space or time, poetry makes them so. All of which is to say, a poem might bring time back to its bodily, its earthly proportions. Poetry might make nothing happen. Inside of which, anything can happen. Maybe most dangerously, our actual fealties, our actual devotions and obligations, which is to say the most rambunctious, mongrel, inconceivable assemblage of each other we could imagine. You ever been on a dance floor like that? Ever on a basketball court like that? Ever in the long, sweaty, collaborative dream of an orchard like that? Ever in a study group like that? A potluck? Ever a forest? Ever a garden? Ever a conversation? A classroom? Ever an impromptu rendition of Shy's If I Ever Fall in Love? Ever a hula hoop gang? Everyone making applesauce from the apples from your beloved neighbor's tree. Everyone trying to get the steps from the video of New Editions If It Isn't Love. Ever on your roller skates, your skateboard, ever making love, ever at a laying out of hands, ever in a dream. Probably I do not need to tell you, but resting inside that nothing happening, inside those idle hands, maybe dormant, maybe like seeds needing fire to germinate, in this case, the fire of hanging out unregulatedly and off the clock, is meaning. We mostly dream, I'm saying, off the clock. And our dreams, well, it's always good to re-remember Audre Lorde, whose brood we are. Quote, our children cannot dream unless they live. They cannot live unless they are nourished. And who else will feed them the real food without which their dreams will be no different than ours? End quote.
And finally, we had the honor of hosting Amani Perry at the American Writers Festival in May to discuss her book, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation, which was just recently awarded the 2022 National Book Award for Nonfiction. Perry discussed the book with fellow author Dawn Turner, and in this clip, she relays the story from the memoir of trying to find common ground and empathy for people with opposing views.
There was another moment that I love with the Lyft driver in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
That's another moment of empathy. When she, this is a woman who is, now she's from North Carolina, yes. The Bible Belt.
Yes.
And so you get into her Lyft, and she says, well, she starts to talk about all kinds, all manner of
all
religious,
her business.
Tammy Faye.
Yes.
Yeah, all of her business, yeah. All of that. And at the end of the ride, she says, do you want to pray with me? And you say, yes.
Yeah.
And I was just, I was really, and I have to say, I grew up in the church, but I was really moved by that because you immediately said yes.
Yeah.
But I love the way you ended that chapter because you were saying, like, I hope you're not praying to the God. If you could pray to the God of the slaves,
yeah.
A more generous God.
Yes.
So talk a little bit
about
that.
Yeah, I draw this distinction in the book between the God of masters and the God of slaves.
Yes.
Is there two competing religious traditions, Christian religious traditions in this country? So her God, she described as someone who, you know, if you were saved, you would rule like sitting next to God, like kings and queens. And I thought, who are you ruling over?
Right.
What are you imagining? And then I thought, in contrast, the tradition out of which I come is one, you know, it's the Exodus tradition.
Yeah.
And so it's a let my people go. It's freedom. And so those, we had the same texts, the same religious texts in a very different interpretation. And her response to her experience of humiliation and degradation and being abandoned by her husband was to imagine being a ruler, right? And I was trying to suggest, oh, but you could imagine the way we do.
Right.
Not imagine being a ruler, right? Imagine being free.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. We'll be off for a week to rest up, but we'll be back in 2023 for another year full of conversations with contemporary authors. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.